Hello. Ahead of a historic performance with the Philadelphia Orchestra at Macy's Center City, Philadelphia, we speak with Peter Richard Conti, the Grand Court Organist of the Wanamaker Organ. And David Patrick Stearns looks back on the history of the Wanamaker Organ and explores the workings of the world's largest functioning musical instrument. Susan Lewis looks at Missing Masters, the Woodmere Art Museum in Philadelphia's new show of African-American art that highlights work that's been missed by the art history books. And Jason Pfeiffer looks at the Tom Stoppard play Rock and Roll as the Wilma Theatre in Philadelphia opens its 30th season. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
This evening, as part of the 150th anniversary celebration of Macy's, the Philadelphia Orchestra will perform at the group's Center City store, home to the Wanamaker organ. The event is also a fundraiser for the organ, the world's largest working musical instrument, which has been played there every day for almost a century. Tonight we'll also see the Philadelphia premiere of Belgian composer Joseph Jongen's Symphony Concertante. The work was commissioned for the Wanamaker organ and the Philadelphia Orchestra in the 1920s, but a series of events postponed its debut until now. Tonight, Wanamaker Grand Court organist Peter Richard Conti will be at the console. So we're sitting at the console of an instrument that is now 104 years old, and I guess that of all those alive, you better than anybody knows the history of it. Tell us about the evolution of this, now the largest functioning musical instrument in the world.
Right. It was actually built originally for the St. Louis World's Fair in 1904 by the Los Angeles Art Organ Company. And at that time, it was the largest organ in the world. It was 10,000 pipes. And when the fair closed, it went into storage. And John Wanamaker purchased it and hauled it here in 13 freight cars and set it up in this amazing grand court for his son Rodman, who was a music aficionado. And here it stands. And when it got here, it wasn't big enough for them or for the space that it was filling. And so they hired a crew of about 40 full-time men just to work on the organ. The 12th floor of this store was an organ shop employing 40 men just to work on the organ. And between 1915 and 1928 or so, they tripled the organ in size to where it is now, which is over 28,500 pipes.
And it really is filling. If we look at the space that it's in, it is, what, six stories high?
The Grand Court actually is seven floors tall, and the organ takes up pretty much the entire south wall of the Grand Court as you look at the Grand Court from inside.
Let's talk about the relationship of what is still referred to as the Wanamaker organ. It didn't change its name as it changed owners.
No, it's sort of like a Steinway piano. If the Joneses buy a Steinway, it's still the Steinway piano in the Joneses' house, you know.
Leopold Stokowski and the Philadelphia Orchestra gave their first Wanamaker organ concert in 1919.
The remarkable thing about this space was it was designed both as a commerce center and as a music center. It fulfilled both duties really well. And in the early 1900s, they would literally clear away all the merchandise, counters, everything from the Grand Court, set up thousands of chairs, and they had these after-hours galas with literally 10,000 people in this Grand Court listening to the Philadelphia Orchestra with Stokowski and either Charles Courbois or Pietro Jan or somebody playing the organ. Really quite remarkable.
So what's the setup going to be for tonight's concert?
Very much like what folks experienced back then during those incredible galas. The orchestra for this event is actually too big to put in the orchestral pit, which is right beneath the main case of pipes. So we have built a huge stage for the orchestra in the Grand Court floor, where women's shoes and fine jewelry are normally, and they will be down there underneath the organ case.
You're used to hearing this organ in this space. Tell me about your thoughts on hearing this with the orchestra.
It is going to be an amazing collaboration. The reports back when Leopold Stokowski did these events were just, people were in awe of the sound, of the combined forces of these two magnificent orchestras, if you will. The Wanamaker organ really is the size of three symphony orchestras, basically, in its scope and tonal palette. So if you're combining basically four symphony orchestras in one room, it's going to be quite a thing to talk about, I have a feeling.
Let's talk about the work. Jongen's Symphony Concertante, it was written for the organ for this organ and for the Philadelphia Orchestra in 1926.
It was commissioned by Rodman Wanamaker, John Wanamaker's son, to inaugurate the completion of the Wanamaker organ in its final 28,000-plus pipes state. And 1926, this commission was made, and one thing led to another. The premiere got pushed back. I think Jean Ganesh actually got sick at one point. And in 1928, Rodman Wanamaker died suddenly. And at his death, all of the grand musical events that were happening ceased to happen. The bean counters, if you will, took over, and there went all the big plans.
So 80 years after it should have taken place, this wonderful concerto for organ and orchestra is taking place on the instrument for which it was designed, with the orchestra for whom it was written. Tell me about your preparation for it.
I get excited for most events that I do, but for this event, I've been on a perpetual floating something or other for months. I mean, years, really. I mean, my predecessor, Keith Chapman, longed to play this piece in this building with that orchestra, because it's the culmination of, you know, so many people's dreams from Rodman right on up. And to have the privilege and honor to be the one at the bench here when this is actually happening is a little overwhelming, actually. So I've been working really, really long hours on it.
Tell me about the mechanics, because I know from having spoken to you before that there is a delay between you actually pushing down on a key here and the note actually happening in the room, which is fine and dandy for you because you're attuned to that. How do you deal with that when working with 100 other musicians?
It's going to be interesting. We have a rehearsal this morning, actually, and I've done some work with brass ensembles, and we actually had the Philadelphia Youth Orchestra in here several years ago. We did the Saint-Saëns Third Organ Symphony in the same kind of configuration, and it works. It's a little bit challenging, but I know the instrument pretty well. I know how to factor in the delay, if you will.
And then just finally, you presumably will be looking at the console while you're performing. You're not going to be able to see the conductor and therefore not able to react to his gestures.
Actually, we've thought about that, and we're actually installing. We're at the console right now, and we're installing a small flat screen that will pull down from behind the music rack. It will block partially the top two keyboards, but I have six. I can use four for this concert and not worry about it. And I will have a direct view of the maestro face-to-face.
Wanamaker Grand Court organist Peter Richard Conti. While the towering array of pipes and the cosmic console are the very public faces of the organ, there's a lot more going on beneath the surface, as the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns discovered.
Walk through a nondescript door on the second floor of Macy's, and you might as well have fallen down an Alice in Wonderland rabbit hole, though the wonder factor is more utilitarian than fantastical. It's the inner workings of the world's largest currently functioning musical instrument, the Wanamaker organ. But before I entered, music director Peter Richard Conti sat at the keyboard, which is nestled in Macy's women's wear department, demonstrating the organ's newly revitalized voices.
This is one of the French horns. Another French horn. Amazing flutes that are in there. It's a gorgeous pipe organ. Another flute. There's a whole, you can see a whole wealth of flutes. This oboe just came back to life last night. And then today, this basset horn, which is a big overgrown clarinet. I think it's cool now.
That's wonderful.
But no one ever heard this stuff. It, at best, in the old configuration, may have sounded this big. Maybe.
Inside the organ, there's a lot less light and a lot more sound. So much that one of last week's noontime concerts had show tunes inflated to a size comparable to the Goodyear blimp. Until recently, a huge amount of sound had to be produced in order to make an impression on listeners in the store. Those majestic pipes that overlook the Grand Court were so closely positioned they blocked sound from getting out. Some of it is more felt than heard, because it's at the outer limits of the human ear. and the means to create it pushed the limits of incredulity in my tour with Philadelphia-raised, New York-based organ technician Peter Batchelder.
Here you get some of the idea of the size of the pipes if you look down here.
Oh, Jesus.
And then look up. This is just to play one note. The zinc is approximately 5/16 of an inch thick to make this pipe, and it's, whoops, and the pipe weighs a little bit over 2,000 pounds. It's just a ton for one note.
On a spare spot of wall space back there, one photo captures the delightfully surreal moment in the organ's installation when a Shetland pony was photographed inside a large pipe. Many such monstrosities stand amid steep, narrow, banister-free stairways that lead to what I call the intensive care ward of the organ, where the Vox Humana pipes, said to sound like a distant choir, are kept. I stood in front of the door and read the warning sign, written in genteel cursive.
Vox Humana Chamber, please help us keep these fussy pipes dust-free and tuned and help keep our new chamber immaculate. Dust is a problem?
Dust is a problem because the pipes, unlike a saxophone or a clarinet, are made of brass. And the brass is much less forgiving than the wood tongue and tube that you see in a clarinet. So if there's any dust or dirt on the surface of the brass, it'll stop the pipe from speaking altogether or prevent it from staying in tune. So we're very fussy about dust and dirt in here, and we don't let anybody come in. You're a special privileged character, so you got in. But,
it's odd to think of any organ as being on the cutting edge. The instrument had its origins in ancient Greece. But the Wanamaker organ was in the 1920s when it was expanded to what it is today. All of the venerable names associated with the instrument, the organist composers Joseph Yongen and Marcel Dupré, weren't venerable when they were beckoned to Philadelphia. They were exploring new possibilities, like pipes made to resemble the saxophone or the English horn, instruments that hadn't been around that long. Dupré improvised what later became his symphony passion here. Yongen wrote his great symphony concertante for this organ, though it'll only be played on the Wanamaker instrument for the first time tonight. You have to ask, how important is this original hardware? Surely, something smaller, less monstrous, and lower maintenance can be devised, and every generation seems to try. In the 1970s, the renowned Virgil Fox recorded the Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony with the Philadelphia Orchestra using an instrument with 144 speakers, as opposed to tens of thousands of pipes. It's convincing, but seems not to have caught on. Now we have virtual organs emitting sampled sound. I heard one in person the other week at Philadelphia's 10th Presbyterian Church, and now on a new Telarc compact disc played by the flamboyant Cameron Carpenter. It's upwardly mobile, well-caffeinated, goal-directed sound. But like so much that is digital, it also lacks dimension and is almost too clean to be poetic. The Wanamaker difference is apparent even when listening to its recordings on my humble earbuds. It's like going from a 100-voice chorus singing at full capacity to a 1,000-voice chorus making less forced sounds with shimmers, layers, and aftertastes. It's a refined sound in reserve. Virtual organs seek out your ears, metaphorically and literally considering their portability. The Wanamaker sound feels like a weather front, blown in by the wind, coalescing into a seemingly fate-dictated contour of great music. But it doesn't come to you. You must come to it.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. This evening at 7:30, Macy's and the Friends of the Wanamaker Organ presents a grand 150th anniversary concert Beecham Grand Court organist Peter Richard Conti with conductor Rossin Milanoff and the Philadelphia Orchestra. The program will include the world premiere of Howard Shore's Fanfare, in addition to Joseph Jungen's Symphony Concertante for organ and orchestra, the first time the work will be performed in the setting for which it was originally intended, by the Philadelphia Orchestra with the Wanamaker Organ. Philadelphia's Woodmere Art Museum focuses on the art and the artists of the Philadelphia region, and its permanent collection of over 600 paintings and sculptures includes works by artists celebrated in the history books, such as Benjamin West, Daniel Garber, and N.C. Wyeth. However, a new exhibition is premised on the idea that art history books are missing a significant chapter. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to In Search of Missing Masters, the Lewis Tanner Moore Collection of African American Art.
In the late 1960s, high school student Lewis Tanner Moore took an art history class and was troubled by the incomplete picture drawn of the American art community. Nearly all of the artists were white males.
There was no mention of any African American artists. We went through the standard texts, and people that looked like me were just absent from those pages.
Moore knew, as well or better than anyone, that African American artists were out there. His granduncle was the post-impressionist painter Henry Ossawa Tanner, who in 1880 was the first black student at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, where he studied with Thomas Aikens. Both affronted and inspired, the teenage Moore put together a small high school art show.
I was able to borrow a piece from Humbert Howard, who was a really major figure in Philadelphia art. I borrowed a piece from Barclay Hendricks. I borrowed a family piece of Tanner's, and had a number of other wonderful artists in that small exhibition.
If you don't recognize all of the names, well, that's the point. Moore's drive to find these missing masters continued, and now, nearly 40 years later, he's accrued a massive collection of African-American art. This show of about 130 paintings, sculpture, and works on paper is just a sample. Significantly, the show also demonstrates that there is no monolithic African-American style. The objects here are so varied that Woodmere Curator of Collections Douglas Pascal chose to usher visitors to the large primary exhibition space through an introductory gallery of works on a variety of themes.
As large as it is, as complex as it is, as multifarious as the works in the show are, you need a buffer zone, a smaller room where they could look around and go, oh gosh, it isn't just African masks. In fact, it's mostly not African masks. It's all kinds of things.
Instead, there are portraits and landscapes, allegorical works and still lifes.
Collage, we have printmaking, we have painting, we have sculpture, we have jokes.
Jokes? Ah, the large painting of a watermelon called There Is No Need for a Title, number 7, a pointed reference to stereotypes. Moore likens the watermelon imagery to Tanner's well-known painting of an African-American troubadour.
Where he took the image of the black man and the banjo, which had been used in minstrelry and in all sorts of hideous and horrible ways as a way of demeaning, and turned it to something that serves rather than demeans, to take back that territory that had been used as a club against you.
The banjo painting is not in the show, but the large gallery begins with Tanner's 1880 traditional-style oil painting of an African lion at the Philadelphia Zoo.
And if you see the lion in captivity, surrounded, there is certainly a wealth of symbolic interpretations that one can take from there.
Tanner and others worked in the mainstream styles of their time. Then came the Harlem Renaissance, from the 1920s to about 1940, when many black artists were encouraged to celebrate their African heritage through art.
That was revitalizing for the community that had been told not to consider its efforts to be worthy.
But African-inspired imagery represented only part of the African-American experience, and some artists resisted. Alan Freelon, who studied at the Barnes, is represented in this show by a 1928 brightly hued impressionist painting of boats in a harbor.
He did not want African Americans to typecast themselves by having only paintings or sculptures of masks and antelopes.
Many artists expressed their personal visions through the evolving styles of the art establishment, from realism to impressionism to surrealism and modern and contemporary art. But into the early 20th century, whatever approach the artists took, there was little demand for any American art, let alone that of African Americans.
We thought European art was what was important. We wanted to fill our Metropolitan Museums of Art with Michelangelos and Goyas and Constables.
It was a time when jazz, with its African-American roots, was on the rise. But fine artists, says Moore, faced greater resistance from the mainstream culture.
It was easier to find ways to enjoy jazz without having a discussion about the fact that Duke Ellington was a genius. Whereas if you are saying Tanner or one of the other artists deserves to be in a museum, you start to use that word, genius.
Yet even without the support of patrons or galleries, let alone museums, these artists continue to create.
There's a painting in there by Ellis Wilson, and people tell a story of Ellis Wilson being in an apartment in New York where he couldn't sell his work, and they kept making his apartment smaller and smaller, and he kept painting and filling up because he needed to express something. He needed to get it onto canvas. And I think that there is an urgency in the best work of a voice that needs to speak.
And that's what the great artists are. They're not making it necessarily for an audience.
But an audience it will have. The work in this show invites us into a whole new world, actually multiple worlds. Large canvases glow with brilliant colors. Detailed drawings explore myth and faith. Works of mixed media experiment with form and texture, each artist telling a different piece of the human story. There is art as old as Tanner's 1880 oil painting and as young as a 2004 work by Sterling Shaw.
And in between there you have people like Sam Gilliam and Barbara Bullock, Don Camp and Mel Edwards and Mo Brooker, and a whole series of people who have sort of represented different aspects of the African-American experience within art.
Names we may or may not know well, yet.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. In Search of Missing Masters, the Lewis Tanner Moore Collection of African-American Art opens tomorrow and runs through February 22nd. On Wednesday evening at 7, Settlement Music School faculty members Chris Rudzinski, Bill Marconi and Yomi Awadizu will perform African percussion pieces. The Wilma Theatre in Philadelphia opened its 30th season this week with a play from an internationally acclaimed writer, very familiar to the company. The works of Tom Stoppard, the Czech-born Briton, have graced the Wilma stage more than any other single playwright, 9 times to date. And as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the latest Wilma production examines the intersection of music and politics.
Stoppard's play Rock and Roll isn't a musical, nor does it set out to trace the history or evolution of rock and roll. As Stoppard explained at the Wilma Theater earlier this year, the play might more accurately be described as a fake autobiography that begins during World War II.
I left Czechoslovakia when I was a baby. My Czech father was killed in the Far East in the war. We were in the Far East. And I guess if my mother hadn't, after the war, married Mr. Stoppard, my stepfather's name, maybe we would have gone back to Czechoslovakia, okay? And I thought it would be quite interesting to write a play about myself, as though at the age of 8 I'd gone to Czechoslovakia instead of to England.
The story spans just over 2 decades, from 1968 to 1990, centering on Max, a Marxist professor in England, and Jan, a Cambridge graduate student who loves his rock and roll record collection. In 1968, Jan has decided to go back to his native Czechoslovakia. On his return, he finds Soviet tanks rolling into Prague to put a stop to political and social reforms. Indirectly, the play also includes the story of a real-life underground Czech rock band called the Plastic People of the Universe, a group much admired by Jan. Increasingly, the government tries to limit their artistic expression. Rock and Roll is a play that the Wilma Theater was eager to produce. Blanca and Yuri Ziska, the artistic directors of the company, have personal connections to the subject matter of this story. They were born in Czechoslovakia, and according to Blanca Ziska, many of the events in the play resonate with what she and Yuri went through before emigrating to the U.S.
So, for instance, the rock and roll group, the Plastic People of the Universe, the members of the group were arrested in February 1976. Our theater was closed down by the government in 1975. It was also an underground theater.
Ziska says it was a time in which politicians were trying to get rid of anything, artistic or otherwise, that seemed to be uncivilized or out of step with the party line. Paul Wilson was an English teacher in Czechoslovakia in the late 60s and 70s. For a time, the Canadian was also a member of the Plastic People of the Universe. Speaking by phone from London, Wilson explained how the Soviet-controlled Czech government cracked down hard on the group.
The restrictions were so heavy that we really had nowhere to practice, and it was very difficult to line up gigs because we didn't have the official kind of license to play that you needed in order to sign contracts and, you know, play in public.
Wilson says the band devised ruses to get around these restrictions. They organized lectures on Andy Warhol art that happened to include a rock concert. Band members and fans who didn't necessarily espouse the notion of marriage would get married so that the Plastic People could play at the wedding. The band eventually became a lightning rod for political resistance in Czechoslovakia, though Wilson says they didn't think of themselves as political.
But they also did not bow to the political demands that were put on rock bands. I mean, after the Russian invasion, a set of rules came down from on high saying that no rock bands could wear long hair, have English titles, sing in a language other than Czech, and the Plastic People broke all those rules. So they weren't specifically political. They were simply doing what they wanted to do.
The political atmosphere of Czechoslovakia during the 70s and 80s figures strongly in Stoppard's Rock and Roll.
But this play is very much about time.
Director Blanka Ziska explains that the theme of the passage of time is reflected in the set design, which sits on a large turntable stage.
People fall in love, people die, people are born, and somehow that turntable and that kind of, you know, unceasing, constant ticking of clock somehow is captured in that.
Ziska says that in contrast to the Broadway version of the play last year, which had a very realistic scenic design, the Wilma went with a very minimalist set, designed by Matt Saunders.
Well, let me show you the other side. The other main space is the inside of this wall.
Saunders explains that the floor and set walls, painted dull gray, have only essential furniture and props. In his view, this simplicity complements Tom Stoppard's dramatic structure.
You know, it's a play about holding true to your ideas and sort of being passionate about your ideas, and it's a play about Marxism and Marxist philosophy. And so I think the set, because of its minimalist approach, I think it's able to support ideas. It's not preoccupied with depicting a realistic location.
Both Matt Saunders and Blanka Ziska also say the turntable set might be thought of as one big record player. It certainly looks like one. And of course, rock and roll does include some rock and roll. Stoppard is very specific about the songs that are to be played between the scenes. Music from now revered acts like, among others, Pink Floyd, Bob Dylan, and the Rolling Stones. Hovering above the turntable stage and its set walls are two large rear projection screens. While music is played between scenes, old video footage from Czechoslovakia is shown. Blanka Ziska spent the better part of a month tracking down the footage, which originates from the 1960s and onward. The images function as a dramatic backdrop to the story of Jan, Max, and the Plastic People of the Universe, providing a larger historic context to Tom Stoppard's fake autobiography. But what provides the tone and rhythm of the archival footage, and in many ways the play as a whole, is the music. And while rock means different things to different people, rock and roll music will be remembered as the soundtrack to a century full of social and political upheaval and sweeping change around the globe.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Tom Stoppard's Rock and Roll runs at the Wilma Theatre through October 26th. And that's it for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.